From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, with the New York Yankees and Arizona Diamondbacks tied 2-2 in the World Series, we'll talk about the current state of baseball with broadcaster Bob Costas. The NBC veteran has been covering pro baseball, football, and basketball for over 20 years. Costas is also the author of Fair Ball, A Fan's Case for Baseball. Also, we've been hearing a lot of Irving Berlin's God Bless America lately. We'll talk to Robert Kimball, co-editor of The Complete Lyrics of Irving Berlin. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new Billie Holiday set of her early Columbia recordings. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. In Los Angeles, California Governor Gray Davis said there are credible threats of a terrorist attack on some of the state's important bridges. We get more on the story from NPR's Ina Jaffe.
Davis said that the threats were reported by several law enforcement agencies, including the FBI. According to those reports, four bridges are possible terrorist targets: the Golden Gate Bridge and the Bay Bridge in San Francisco, the Coronado Bridge in San Diego, and the Vincent Thomas Bridge at the Port of Los Angeles. The attacks would take place during rush hour sometime in the next 8 days. The Coast Guard and the State Highway Patrol have increased their surveillance of the four potential targets. Speaking at a news conference in Los Angeles, Davis said it's best to let the terrorists know that we know what they're up to and we're ready. He said it will be up to individual commuters to decide whether or not to use the bridges during this time. Ina Jaffe, NPR News, Los Angeles.
The House has begun debating airport security legislation. Lawmakers are deciding if every airport screener should be a federal worker. That's the course the Senate has approved. But House Republican leaders are pushing a bill that calls for federal supervision of screeners who would remain private employees. The vote is expected to be close. President Bush made a push for the GOP bill during a meeting with Republicans today. House Minority Leader Dick Gephardt says he's cautiously hopeful of winning over enough moderate Republicans to pass the Senate bill. Officials in Kansas are continuing to test workers at a postal facility where anthrax spores have been discovered. Matt Hackworth of member station KCUR reports.
Over 200 employees at a stamp processing center are filing into the Kansas City Health Department to be tested for anthrax infections. Their workplace cancels mail for stamp collectors and received mail from the contaminated Washington, D.C. Brentwood Mail Center. Kansas City Health Department Director Dr. Rex Archer says that at first, officials here didn't feel the Kansas City facility could have been infected.
Clearly, we did not expect that these samples were going to be positive, but the prudent thing was to go ahead and test because they've been in the facility.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention continues to run more extensive tests at the facility, and employees have been placed on antibiotics as a precaution. For NPR News, I'm Matt Hackworth in Kansas City.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has issued a warning to doctors who are prescribing antibiotics for possible anthrax exposure. The concern is over pregnant women getting the anti-anthrax drug doxycycline. The CDC says it can stunt fetal growth. Instead, the government is urging doctors to prescribe Cipro to pregnant women. Stock prices were generally higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average up 188 points at 92.63. The Nasdaq was up 56 at 17.46. The S&P 500 rose 24 to finish at 10.84. This is NPR News. The judge who presided over Sarah Jane Olson's case said today he's going to hold a special session to consider whether the guilty plea entered by the former Symbionese Liberation Army fugitive remains valid. The action by Superior Court Judge Larry Fidler comes in the wake of statements Olson made following her plea. Olson admitted in court that she was guilty of possessing bombs with intent to murder police officers, then left court and declared she was innocent. Washington State's highest court has ruled that homosexual couples are on the same legal footing as unmarried heterosexual couples when it comes to dividing property. NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports.
Today's opinion is believed to be the first time that a state high court has found that a person's sexual orientation cannot stop him from claiming his share of a couple's assets. The court said that the plaintiff in this case, an older man, does not automatically get those assets, but for the first time, a gay man will have a chance to show that he was part of a couple and should be treated the same as any other surviving partner. Lisa Stone is executive director of the Northwest Women's Law Center.
This case is important because it's an acknowledgement by the Washington Supreme Court that there are lots of different kinds of families in our state and in our country, and they are all entitled to respect before the law.
Stone says gays and lesbians in other states are likely to cite the Washington case in their efforts to get the same rights as unmarried heterosexual couples. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News, Seattle.
President Bush today continued sanctions against Sudan. The president said he's extended the sanctions for another year because of Sudan's reputation for international terrorism and human rights abuses. The sanctions do not affect U.S. humanitarian activities in Sudan. I'm Frank Stacio, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Merrill Lynch, offering customized wealth management services for qualified investors. 1-800-MERRILL or www.askmerrill.ml.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. This year's World Series has had some classic moments, pitting the team with the biggest payroll in baseball, the New York Yankees, against the Arizona Diamondbacks, a Sun Belt expansion team also heavily stocked with highly paid veteran players. Sports broadcaster Bob Costas likes the drama of this year's series, but is worried about the future of baseball. Costas has won 11 Emmys and has been named National Sportscaster of the Year 7 times. He'll anchor NBC's coverage of the Olympics next year and is host of On the Record with Bob Costas on HBO. He's also the author of Fair Ball, A Fan's Case for Baseball, which argues that short-sighted owners and player reps are undermining the fairness of the competition on the field. I spoke with Bob Costas from his office in St. Louis. Bob Costas, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Dave.
You've written a book, Fair Ball, A Fan's Case for Baseball. It was released last year. But in that book, you've made the case that the difference in player payrolls among competing teams has become so lopsided that we've got about two-thirds of baseball's franchises that start the year with virtually no chance of going all the way. Why is baseball different? How have other sports avoided that?
Well, for example, football has a built-in situation that allows them to make sense of their finances. There are no local broadcast revenues to speak of because every game is a network telecast and there are only 16 games. And that network money for the NFL is larger than baseball, basketball, and hockey combined. So the single greatest source of revenue is easily divided equally among all the teams. And it's difficult for local revenue to make that much of a difference. So right there, they've equalized it. And then on top of that, they put in a salary cap, which some teams try to circumvent, but at least it provides some sort of check, puts some sort of check in place to keep one team from just running wild with their payroll. Basketball doesn't have quite as tidy a situation as football, but at least they do have some sort of salary cap situation in place. Baseball has nothing like that, and they have enormous differences in local revenues. The Yankees might generate $100 million more in local revenue than a team like the Twins or the A's or the Expos or the Pirates or the Royals. Now, occasionally, very occasionally, a team like Oakland, which has been extremely resourceful and very smart with their front office moves, a team like Oakland might defy the odds and put together a playoff team a couple of years in a row. But eventually, reality sets in, and they have to deal with how they'll hold that team in place with free agency and with arbitration coming up. And it's just not possible, no matter how smart you are, when you have a tiny payroll, it's just not possible to have sustained excellence the way the Yankees and the Braves and some other clubs have been able to do.
So in baseball, you have teams with four or five times the player payroll as
That's
other
right.
teams.
And potentially growing. For example, the Yankees' local television situation is going to kick up even more next year, to well over $100 million for the Yankees alone beginning next year. And remember, there is no new Yankee Stadium yet. There's no new Shea Stadium. There's no new Dodger Stadium, which would provide additional, at least in theory, provide additional revenues for those large market teams that already have huge advantages over their competitors.
You argue that a crucial turning point in the game came in 1994. What did the owners do then that undermined the long-term health of the game?
Well, they were spoiling for a fight with the players. They were right to this extent. They were right in saying that baseball's economy was going off the rails. They saw the situation developing, which has only grown worse in the last 6 or 7 years. The problem was they had no comprehensive vision for what should take the place of the existing system. They didn't come forward and say, look, here's a comprehensive revenue-sharing plan in which we're asking the wealthiest owners to sacrifice much more than we would ask the players to sacrifice. But we do ask the players to come aboard with us in partnership. If we have a revenue-sharing plan that makes sense, if we modify free agency and make everyone a free agent after 4 years instead of six, if we give you some things in return, would you accept some sort of restraints on salary? Perhaps restraints that might affect superstars, but that in truth would probably not hurt the rank-and-file player, if anything might help the circumstances of the rank-and-file player. And we'll make sure, if we're going to have revenue sharing and if we're going to have a cap on salaries or some sort of significant luxury tax over a certain threshold that would act as a drag on salaries, we'll make sure that the teams in the small and middle markets are required to spend a minimum amount on payroll, so that you're not going to have teams spending $25 or $30 million while others are spending close to $100 million. We'll require not just some sort of ceiling, but some sort of floor, which would give almost every team a chance to be competitive with a little bit of luck and a little bit of resourcefulness. But they didn't do that. They simply came to the players and said, look, we don't like the current situation. We're going to try to shove a salary cap down your throat. It was very obvious they were trying to provoke a strike, and they were hopeful that if they held out long enough, that the players might capitulate. And the players did go on strike, and it blew off the 1994 World Series, and maybe the owners would have gotten a portion of what they were looking for, even without some sort of real vision for the game's future. But at the last minute, a federal judge ordered the players back on the field, and the strike ended early in the 1995 season. So all that was accomplished was that they lost the World Series, they alienated millions of fans, the owners achieved no real reform of the game's ailing economics, and all the problems they were talking about in 1994 have only gotten worse at the turn of the century.
So we're left with a lack of revenue sharing among the wealthy teams and no restraint at all on the high salaries of expensive free agents and where we were.
At the moment, that's right.
Your book took on some of the most powerful people in the game, the owners and the Players Association, and at least by extension, some of the most highly paid free agent players. What sort of reaction have you gotten in the year since you published the book?
Very, very positive from baseball fans, very positive from the press. A lot of general managers and owners not only told me that they felt that I made good points, but actually solicited input on my input on ideas to formulate strategies. The Blue Ribbon panel appointed by Commissioner Selig came out 3 or 4 months after my book was published with its report and reached many of the same conclusions that I had reached. They had somewhat different data and they had access to some information which I didn't, but their essential conclusion, at least regarding the game's economics, was pretty much the same. Players have not been hostile either. You know, I think that players sometimes listen to their agents and they may get focused on their own situation and they may consider it a tremendous injustice that they make $8 million when someone they think is they're as good as might be making $11 million. But when you sit down with them and ask them to look at the game overall and the what might be best for the game as an institution, they're hard-pressed to argue that the present system really serves fans well or that it serves most players well. What it shouldn't competitive balance or something approaching competitive balance be considered a working condition by a union? Why should you consign more than half the players in baseball to teams that have no practical chance to win, not just midway through the season, but on opening day? So I think you'd be surprised. Maybe they wouldn't stand up and say it in union meetings, but you might be surprised how many players see merit in some of these ideas. And it remains to be seen how reasonable they're going to be, but the first move belongs to the owners. The players should not be asked to make any changes unless the owners first present to them a convincing and comprehensive plan that deserves a response.
When the Yankees and the Mets met in a Subway Series last year, TV ratings were disappointing. Do you think that is an indication that fans are being turned off by this pattern of rich teams making the playoffs?
Yeah, in part, I think so. In part, I think a good segment of the country said, okay, two New York teams. Not only are we disinterested or uninterested because of geography, but this is indicative of the stacked deck that baseball fans have been complaining about for a long time. Now, that's not entirely fair to a team like the Yankees, for example, because they're very well managed both in the front office and in the dugout, and they do deserve a lot of credit for the way they've played the hand that's been dealt to them. But I think generally there's a kind of resentment. It may not be true this year, post-September 11th, but over the years there's resentment toward the Yankees because they win all the time. And then when you throw the Mets into the mix, I think a good portion of the country said, you know, what does this have to do with our team and our chances? So the heck with it.
You know, the Arizona Diamondbacks are an expansion team, but they're not poor. I mean, their payroll,
right,
I believe, was $82 million when they started the year, as opposed to the Yankees, $109 million. So in this series, again, we really have kind of two of the financial aristocracies of baseball. Does that make it a less exciting fall classic for you?
No, you can look at the games on their own merits. Look at each game and each pitcher-hitter matchup and the strategy in the dugout, and you can enjoy it as a best-of-seven test between two excellent teams. But when you look at baseball overall, when you go back to spring training next year, you realize that with the occasional exception like the Oakland A's, all you have to do is look at the playoff qualifiers since the mid-90s, and the pattern is just overwhelming. There is a direct connection between payroll size and success. Does a large payroll guarantee that you'll win or contend for the pennant? No, it doesn't. You can screw up even with a large payroll. But a small payroll virtually guarantees that you have no shot.
My guest is sportscaster Bob Costas. He's the author of Fair Ball, A Fan's Case for Baseball. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, back with sportscaster Bob Costas. You know, you've written that you like many sports, but you have a real love for baseball. And you were quoted as saying once that the things that appeal to us about football are inferior to the things that appeal to us about baseball. What did you mean?
Oh, I don't know. I don't even remember that quote, and those things tend to get jerked out of context. Not that you're doing that, Dave, and people want to portray me and others who have ever mentioned, even once or twice, the undeniable fact that baseball has a richer history than other sports and that people may relate to it in a different way than they do other sports, and it may have a little touch of romance that other sports do not. Some people tend to caricature that and try to make us all sound like a bunch of guys in bow ties and tweed jackets with patches on the elbows, drawing on a pipe in some ivory tower someplace and growing misty-eyed at the reading of the infield fly rule. And that's just nonsense. It's not how I view the game. It's not how I grew up with the game. You know, I do think that while I've been a football fan all my life and I admire the skills of the players, football is a violent game. It's a spectacle. Baseball is a pastime. I think that baseball has a different texture to it, a different rhythm and pace to it than other sports do. I don't want to go overboard. I don't want the violin strings to start in the background. After all, I grew up in the 50s and early 60s, and baseball was still the national pastime then. Someone who's 30 years old instead of approaching 50 years old may view it differently, and that's fine too.
Well, there is something different about a game that is played every day. I mean, it's sort of like you see your family every day, whereas football is this huge emotional thing that happens once a week. So it's,
right,
it's a different sensibility.
It's a spectacle, and emotions have to run high to even play the game. Whereas if you played 162 baseball games at anything like the fever pitch that an NFL team plays each of 16 games, your entire roster would be in the loony bin by the All-Star break.
You did write in your book that baseball owners have made a mistake in trying to imitate the sort of snap and flash of professional basketball, right?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think the essential appeal of baseball is retro. And that doesn't mean that you don't modernize. It doesn't mean you don't use the internet for marketing purposes or that you don't use modern advertising techniques or you don't try to consider what might make the game more appealing to younger fans. But you can't be something that you're not. even if you tried to add all kinds of flash and dash to baseball, it would never have the same kind of appeal as basketball. It doesn't appeal to the same part of us that football does. It's dependent on history. It's dependent on context in a way that other sports aren't. While there are certainly moments of contact and intensity in baseball, its general tone is a gentler tone. And a more leisurely tone than other sports. And I think baseball ought to emphasize that proudly as an alternative rather than almost apologizing for its basic appeal and saying to those who aren't baseball fans to begin with, don't worry, we're trying to be more like the sports that you do like. That's never going to work. You have to be true to yourself. Now, you can update a little bit, but you have to be true to your essence, and I think sometimes baseball hasn't done that.
How have you seen owners sort of overreach and make mistakes trying to be like the...
Well, I think there's a lot of gimmickry in modern baseball. I'm amazed that so many fans and members of the press think the wild card is a good idea. It is just impossible, not unlikely, it is impossible to have a meaningful race for first place among any of the three best teams in the league under the wild card system. And I keep hearing how the wild card increases excitement. Virtually every team that has a shot at the wild card would also have a shot at first place. So the wild card as a fallback actually takes away most of the drama that pennant races used to have. And interleague play, I think, is another example. A smidgen of interleague play is fine, but they bent over backwards with this gimmick and decided, oh, interleague play, now we've moved into the modern era, and anybody who disapproves of this is just a hidebound traditionalist. Well, except for Yankees, Mets, and White Sox, Cubs, and a few other matchups, does anybody really care if the Twins play the Cardinals? They don't care at all. And yet this is trumpeted as if this is a big deal. And the way they scheduled it seemed to make little sense. They should have rotated it around so that you got at least an occasional glimpse once every 3 or 4 years at teams that otherwise wouldn't come to your city. They sold out to television to the point where kids on school nights can't see even half of a World Series game. It seems like if someone throws an extra nickel their way, they'll prostitute the game and its long-range best interest just to pick up that extra nickel. So, I think they've done that in a number of ways.
When you and I were kids, we remember televisions being brought into school to see the World Series. Right?
Yeah, it had a special kind of communal feeling to it. I'm not suggesting that they should play every game in the afternoon. More of America can see it when the games are played at night. But why does a game have to start at 8:30 Eastern time? Why not start the midweek games at 7:30 Eastern time and at least play some of the weekend games in the late afternoon to give it some sense of the fall classic?
My guest is sports broadcaster Bob Costas. One of the things we've been hearing since September 11th is that America is now being carried into the modern age of violence and terrorism that much of the world has already experienced. You're going to be involved in covering the Olympics again soon. Will the coverage of the Olympics be different? Will it be harder to get close-ups, to get access to the athletes? Will the kinds of things viewers want to know be different? I mean, how in the post-September 11th atmosphere is it going to be different?
Well, Dave, I have always felt that the Olympics should properly be viewed as both a news event and a sports event. Now, the philosophy of networks covering the Olympics might not always reflect that, but I've always felt that we were a little long on the drama and soap opera end and a little short on the news end. That's just my personal take. I think that post-September 11th, with an Olympics taking place in the United States, the vast majority of viewers are going to have an interest not just in the competition, but in all the circumstances surrounding the Olympics, the practicality of holding them, the questions of security, the questions of the Olympics in the future, what kind of job can Athens do staging an Olympics in 2004? It was apparently a challenge for them to begin with, and now with an increased concern about terrorism, are they up to that challenge? Looking down the road, what about an Olympics in China in 2008? What about all the other issues, not necessarily related to terrorism, but are beyond the field issues in the Olympics, performance-enhancing drugs, the practicality of the bid process and the corruption that was exposed over the past several years. All those things, I think, are very interesting aspects of the Olympics that should be treated journalistically, that should be handled with with in-depth interviews and with commentary. And at the same time, you can revel in all the excitement of the competition, all the drama, all the personal stories. I'm not saying do away with the standard aspects of Olympic coverage. That's fine. I like those too. But I think there should be a larger dose of news involved in Olympic coverage. And this time around, there's almost no excuse not to go in that direction, because the events post-September 11th almost push us in that direction.
Well, I almost hesitate to ask, but is NBC giving its crew training in the possibility of suddenly converting from a sports event to a national crisis?
Well, as we speak, Dave, we're about a week away from an Olympic seminar in Salt Lake City. We'll be there, the entire NBC crew, the producers, the researchers, the announcers, everyone involved. And I'm sure that subject will come up, but I'm not exactly sure what NBC's plan is. I'll know a little bit more as the games approach.
Sportscaster Bob Costas. He's the host of On the Record with Bob Costas on HBO. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, promoting excellence in journalism worldwide and investing in the vitality of 26 U.S. communities. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our interview with sportscaster Bob Costas. Also, we talk about Irving Berlin's anthem, God Bless America, with Robert Kimball, co-editor of a new book of Berlin's lyrics. And Kevin Whitehead reviews a new Billie Holiday box set. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. We're speaking with sportscaster Bob Costas. He's the author of Fair Ball, A Fan's Case for Baseball. I talked to Costas about what's special about calling a baseball game. Baseball is a game which is played at a pace, which leaves a lot of room for a broadcaster to do things. I mean, you find some like Vin Scully in Los Angeles who seems to fill every space with something that's sort of interesting, but he keeps talking. Other broadcasters use silence almost as part of the broadcast. Mm-hmm. How do you approach that?
Well, of course, on television, you can use silences to a greater extent than you can on radio. And Vin Scully made his mark initially on radio. And he has such a distinctive voice and such command of his craft that I think what works for him would not work for almost anybody else. He also works alone, remember, which a lot of people take for granted. And yet, think about it. He's the only broadcaster who, on a consistent basis, works alone. So he doesn't have to make spaces.
It's practically unheard of, really, in the
right.
business now.
And no one else could pull it off as well, but he has the ability to do it. If you watch a Dodger telecast, and you're sophisticated enough to pick up on this, you also see that the telecast is directed differently than almost any other baseball telecast, locally or nationally, in that the telecast is done from the inside out. The director follows what Scully says, rather than putting up shots that Scully then has to react to and put captions beneath. Now, the director will occasionally, if you find a cute little kid in the stands or some irresistible shot someplace that would be interesting, the director might do that on their own. But by and large, they're reacting off what Vin finds interesting and what Vin wants to talk about, which allows him to establish a rhythm rather than chasing pictures all over the place, which is what many broadcasters find themselves doing. They're constantly reacting to pictures that go up almost randomly. When a director and announcer are in sync, however, then there should be less of that, and it should have a kind of an organic flow to it.
One of the real challenges of a play-by-play broadcaster is when an exciting play is happening. It happens at a fast pace, and excitement tends to grow, and your voice can quickly start to race. I think you've been very effective in using few words and words at a conversational pace as sort of a counterpunch to the action. Is that something that you developed over time? Did you have to practice it?
You know, I think you develop techniques sometimes without realizing it. You just kind of, as you do it, You figure out what works and what doesn't work, and it starts to come more naturally to you. One of the things that I discovered is that especially if the play is exciting to the home crowd, the crowd's audio is going to get up there more quickly than the audio man in the truck can adjust the announcer's audio. So you need to get out. You need to make your statement before the crowd really reacts. Otherwise, you're fighting the crowd, and what you say kind of gets lost, and subliminally, it seems less effective to the audience. So if you can get on the call of a home run and basically get it out there before the crowd has totally reacted, before delirium is set in, and then just lay out and let the crowd take it while the guy runs around the bases, that's probably the best way to do it.
As a journalist who's done reporting beyond the world of sports, I'm wondering if you find when you're in locker rooms or in a sports environment that you are around people who seem to know or care about little else besides sports, and if that ever becomes tiresome. Do you ever get tired of being around sports folks?
No, I don't get tired of it. I enjoy it. A great sports event is a drama without a script, and you try to take it on its own terms. It's a great common denominator. It cuts across all lines. That may sound trite, but people of varying backgrounds have an interest in sports. I don't think it's necessary to be sports obsessed, where you listen to the talk shows several hours a day and get all worked up over every single ball game or who the Seahawks are going to take in the third round of the draft. There is a little bit of sports nerddom out there, and you know, if you were ever bitten by that, you ought to outgrow it as the years go by. But I hope I never lose my excitement over big events and great performances and walking into an arena or a stadium where a championship is on the line or something interesting might happen. No, I never look down on it. I don't know that I'd be happy if that was all my life was about, but the portion of my life that is about sports is something that I enjoy a lot.
What do you read when you're not reading sports?
Well, these days, not as much in terms of books as periodicals and newspapers. Like everybody else, I'm trying to stay up on the events post September 11th. I read five or six newspapers a day and any number of magazines. I like history and biographies and that sort of thing when I'm reading non-sports books.
Does it inform your coverage, do you think?
Not directly, but probably in some way. I think the greater your frame of reference, the better broadcaster you'll be, no matter what your area of concentration is. It tends to help if you've got some background beyond just the preparation for that particular event. But I'm not the kind of broadcaster who makes literary references or that sort of thing. It amuses me sometimes when people confuse me with those who do. I don't know quite where they make that association with me, but I'm not the sort of guy who would draw a connection between Henry James and former Cardinal and Yankee Charlie James. It just doesn't work that way. It's goofy, and I don't know why people would ever think that I would do something like that. And I've heard that suggested, and apparently they're confusing me with some other Bob Costas.
Yeah, I thought you were known for a line about the myth of Sisyphus and some event.
Yeah, right. I think I did once make a reference to Sisyphus with regard to the Buffalo Bills pushing the rock to the top of the mountain every year by winning the AFC and then having it roll back on top of them in the Super Bowl. But that was one time only, and I stopped after that.
Did your relationship with your father breed this interest in sports and baseball in you, you think?
Oh, I think like a lot of kids, our parents first introduced us to sports. In my case, it was my father. He was an avid sports fan, baseball especially. I grew up in New York in the 50s. It was a hotbed of baseball. Many of the greatest announcers were plying their trade in the New York area, so I got to hear them, and they drew me in to the game. And going to a ball game with your dad was a big thing, especially then when fewer games were on television, and even then it was a black and white television. So the idea of going to the ballpark and seeing all the sights and sounds so vividly and doing it with your dad, I don't think this is at all unique to me. I think millions of kids of my generation had the same experience, and it was a way to have something in common with your father. It was an entry point. It was a conversation in which a 10-year-old kid's opinion might matter as much as his 40-year-old dad. So I could talk to my dad about baseball and other sports, and it was part of our relationship.
Well, Bob Costas, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Dave, thank you.
NBC sportscaster Bob Costas. He's host of On the Record with Bob Costas on HBO. Here's comic Robert Klein.
I used to go to Yankee Stadium and used to sit upstairs for $1.25, sneak down for the last out by the box seats, right? Right. Have you ever done that? Anyone here? You're under arrest, sir. What a minor crime that is, really. You know, sneaking down for the last out on a Tuesday afternoon, the Yankees were winning 15-2. It was in September, it was 40 degrees. There's very little chance that the president of IBM is going to use his box seat that day for the last out. You know, who knows, he'll come along, Beaver, where's my seat? Where's that little punk? Get him out of here. So I sneaked down the last out and the stadium cop would chase us. Really, I guess he was just doing his job. Overreacted a little bit, drew his gun. Get out of there, kid. Come on. Biting his lip, wanting us to act up, you know. All athletes sound alike when they're interviewed. They all sound Southern. Well, my arm's feeling real good, Ralph. I feel I can't help this ball club. It's a good ball club. And we got good defense on this ball club. I feel we can't help this ball club. It's a good ball club. You know. Doesn't matter where he's from. He could be a Rhodes Scholar. Yes, but extemporating that afterwards. I've got an interview now, but I'll be right with you, Matthew. My arm's feeling real good, Ralph. I feel I can't help this ball club. It's a good ball club. And we got good pitching on the ball club. Thank you.
That's Dawn Sternberg on mandolin. Coming up, Irving Berlin's God Bless America. This is Fresh Air. Before the seventh inning of every World Series game and at many other public events since September 11th, crowds have sung Irving Berlin's God Bless America. Berlin was born in Russia. He was 5 years old when his family emigrated to the United States in 1893. Berlin wrote many classic American songs, including Blue Skies, Cheek to Cheek, There's No Business Like Show Business, and White Christmas. Terry Gross spoke recently with music historian Robert Kimball, who, along with Berlin's daughter Linda Emmett, has co-edited a new collection of Berlin's lyrics, The Complete Lyrics of Irving Berlin. Before we hear their conversation, here's Berlin singing God Bless America, recorded in 1939.
God bless America, land that I love, stand beside her and guide her through the night with a light from above, from the mountain to the prairies, to the oceans, white with foam. God bless America, my home, sweet.
Robert Kimball, welcome to Fresh Air. Irving Berlin always thought that God Bless America was the most important song he wrote. Do you know why he thought that?
There's no question that it embodied for him all his feelings about his adopted country, about what the U.S. had given him. He had a fabulous life in America, and this was his way, a small way for him, because he said it was really just a token of his appreciation for America.
Now, he wrote God Bless America in 1918 for a review that he wrote while serving in the Army called Yip Yip Yap Hank. He was stationed in Yap Hank, Long Island. But he didn't use it in the review. Do you know why?
He thought it was just the wrong tone for the finale of the show. He didn't feel comfortable with it at that time. So he removed it during rehearsal, and he closed the show, as I think, with a song called We're On Our Way to France, which is quite lively and fun in its own right.
Berlin really had a sense that music helped define what it was to be an American and that music was really one of our strengths. Like for his 1918 musical Yip Yip Yap Hank during World War I, he wrote this song called Send a Lot of Jazz Bands Over There. It was his message to President Wilson. And it was, send a lot of jazz bands over there to make the boys feel glad. Send a troop of Alexanders with the ragtime band to Flanders and make them play a lot of snappy airs. And he manages to plug his own song in there, too, Alexander's Ragtime Band. have you been thinking a lot about the songs that Berlin wrote for World War I and World War II?
Well, of course, if we look back over that 80 years in which he was writing songs, an extraordinarily long period, 40 of which he was considered the top songwriter in the profession, we see that he reflected whatever was going on in the world. He had an extraordinary ear. He listened and retained very, very well. And so during the wartime, he felt a sense of mission and purpose. And he felt it again, of course, in World War II when he wrote This is the Army. And he wanted to be close to the soldiers. And for him, the experience in World War II traveling with the troupe, being part of it, was for, I think he thought it was the most important experience of his life.
Having put together the book of Irving Berlin lyrics, is there a lyric or two that particularly stands out to you, either in the rhyme scheme or in the sentiment it expresses or in the way it captures the moment that it was written in?
Terry, that's a very hard question, but I could think of a few, obviously. One of which I've thought about a lot, and recently, certainly in recent weeks, was a song that was introduced by Fred Astaire. And the sentiments in the lyric are really, really, really timely. Lines like, "There may be trouble ahead, and there may be teardrops to shed." Of course, I'm speaking of a song, well, Let's Face the Music and Dance, which was introduced in the 1936 film Follow the Fleet. It is certainly one of Mr. Berlin's greatest songs.
Well, why don't we end with that? It's a wonderful song. So this is Fred Astaire singing Irving Berlin's Let's Face the Music and Dance. And my guest, Robert Kimball, is the co-editor of the new book, The Complete Lyrics of Irving Berlin.
There may be trouble ahead, but while there's moonlight and music and love and romance, let's face the music and dance. Before the fiddlers have fled, before they ask us to pay the bills, and while we still have the chance, let's face the music and dance. Soon we'll be without the moon, humming a different tune, and then there may be teardrops to shed. So while there's moonlight and music and love and romance, let's face the music and dance, dance. Let's face the music and dance.
Robert Kimball co-edited a new collection of Irving Berlin's lyrics. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead's review of a new box set of recordings from Billie Holiday. This is Fresh Air. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new 10-CD set of recordings Billie Holiday made for Columbia between 1933 and 1944. Kevin says it's hard to overestimate the influence Holiday has had over singers as diverse as Frank Sinatra, Carmen McRae, Bob Dylan, and others. Holiday's own inspiration was the same as most jazz musicians, Louis Armstrong. You can hear his influence in the way she phrases on a warm-up take to 1938's Now They Call It Swing, a song about the rapid changes jazz was going through.
Once they called it ragtime, and it had its fling. It's the same old syncopation, now they call it swing. Then they played it jazz time to a bucking wing. Once again it sweeps the nation, now they call it swing. When singers used to sing, they would go hot shine.
It's amazing how quickly jazz developed early on. Jelly Roll Morton's Red Hot Peppers, the swing era, bebop, rhythm and blues, cool jazz, and the first stirrings of the avant-garde all happened in the space of 30 years. Billie Holiday always sounded so modern, it's easy to forget how young jazz was when she debuted in 1933. Rank-and-file jazz musicians had learned to swing only recently, and for years yet, a hip tune might end with a whiff of Dixieland.
Lovely, never, never change. Keep that breathless charm. Won't you please arrange it, 'cause I love you just the way you look tonight.
Billie Holiday's light and reedy voice was so far from Armstrong's gravel pipes, the phrasing he pioneered took on a totally different effect. On her breezy early recordings, that one was from 1936, her timing floated like a balloon, helium to Armstrong's hailstorm. That buoyancy is one thing she had in common with her favorite accompanist, Lester Young. But she also sounded good paired with other tenor saxophonists, including Ben Webster, and on this next one, Joe Thomas. He gets her spring in his step.
So if you like pajamas and I like pajamas, I'll wear pajamas, give up pajamas, for we know we need each other, so we better call the call in our form. Let's call the whole thing off.
There's a sweetness about some of Billie Holiday's early sides you can overlook, given her powerful ballads. But on slow numbers, in her speech-like middle register, her voice had a vulnerability that pulled her out of Armstrong's orbit and went straight for your heart. Here's Holiday in 1939 on what she called her favorite song by Irene Kitchings and Arthur Herzog.
Some other spring, when twilight falls, will the night spring another to me? Not your kind, but let me find. It's not true that love is blind. Sun shines around me, but deep in my heart, it's cold as ice. Once you found me, but can that story unfold twice? Some other.
A lot of singers learned a lot from Billie Holiday about a conversational delivery, emotional shading, and quietly rewriting melodies to improve them or suit your range. Many songs she sang were no great shakes in themselves, but the body of work she recorded for Columbia between 1933 and 41 includes some of the best jazz singing anyone ever did. It's high time they were collected in one place, with a few radio performances thrown in as extras, although 10 CDs will be more than enough for some.
Lips are singing love. All worries have passed. Then I'll get that feeling. You're too lovely to last.
The music's great, but the lavish packaging, which resembles a fold-out album of old 78s, is like an architect's vanity project, classy on the outside, but ill-suited to daily use. The inside is an intricate construction of heavy paper that looks a bit fragile for the job of holding the CDs and a big floppy book. You want to play this stuff, not encase it in glass. The book's text is kind of a mess. One essay gets the date of Billie's death wrong by 10 years. There are three discs of alternate takes, dozens newly issued in the States, but the track notes, recycled from earlier issues, take no notice of those. Since some jazz fans are suspicious of alternates to begin with, you should at least tell them where some of the highlights are. Them that gets deserve to know what they got.
jazz critic Kevin Whitehead. He reviewed the complete Billie Holiday on Columbia. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Them that's got shall get, them that's not shall lose. So the Bible said, and it still is news. My mommy have, papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own, that's got his own. Yes, the strong gets more while the weak ones fade. Empty pockets don't ever make the grade. Mama may have, papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own, that's got his own.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from Dell Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Going to the Movies, a personal journey through four decades of modern film by Sid Field, author of screenplay, and from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The 1954 Oscar-winning film On the Waterfront has just been released on DVD. On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, we hear from Elia Kazan, who won the Oscar for Best Director, and Eva Marie Saint, who won for Best Supporting Actress. Join us for the next Fresh Air.